Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Next week, Christians around the world will begin the most solemn period on their religious calendar, Lent, a time of fasting and quiet contemplation in preparation for Easter. In preparation for Lent, however, many people will engage in one of the wildest bits of revelry of the year, Mardi Gras. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Reed Mitchell about the history of Mardi Gras in one of its best-known locations, New Orleans. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. On February 9, 1825, we experienced one of those quirks in the presidential election system that are theoretically possible but seldom occur. John Quincy Adams was elected President of the United States, even though he did not win the popular election. There were four candidates in the election of 1824, none of whom received the majority of the electoral votes. Under provisions in the U.S. Constitution that are still there, the matter was submitted to the House of Representatives for resolution. Andrew Jackson received the greatest number of popular votes and electoral votes in the national election, but the House voted Adams into office. When Henry Clay, one of the other candidates, withdrew his name in Adams' favor. When Adams later appointed Clay Secretary of State, cries of corrupt bargain could be heard throughout the land. Turning to items of interest in the news, 5,300-year-old clay tablets uncovered in southern Egypt from the tomb of a king named Scorpion may represent the earliest known writing. If confirmed, the discovery would rank among the greatest in the search for the origin of the written word. 225 Americans who survived World War II concentration camps will be paid as much as $25 million by Germany under a settlement the U.S. government has won for the Nazi victims. Germany has paid billions of dollars in war reparations over the years, of course, but the U.S. did not join other countries in making a claim immediately after the war, apparently because few U.S. citizens came forward at the time. And some 80-plus scientists have gathered online to nominate what they consider to be the most important inventions of the past 2,000 years. They are reading glasses, the printing press, the clock, plumbing, the stirrup, numbers, erasers, and delete keys, the birth control pill, classical music, and, of course, the computer. I would also add to that list the radio on which you are listening to Talking History. Next week, people from around the nation and the world will gather in New Orleans for Carnival, Mardi Gras, or Fat Tuesday, one of the best-known and wildest events on that city's calendar. Here to explore its history is Creighton historian Eileen Dugan, who will be talking to a special guest for today's show.
In the days preceding the solemnity of Lent, many Christian societies indulge in the no-holds-barred revelry of Carnival. To the Germans, it is called Fasching. In Brazil, it is the Dazzling Carnival. But perhaps none is more famous than the Mardi Gras of New Orleans. Each year, countless people descend upon the Crescent City to participate in Mardi Gras. To many, it is a magical time to shed their inhibitions and turn the world upside down. But what is Mardi Gras? What is its purpose? And what does it say about New Orleans culture? With us today to explore the history of Mardi Gras is Dr. Reed Mitchell, Associate Professor of History at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Dr. Mitchell is a native of New Orleans who specializes in Civil War and Southern history. He is the author of All on a Mardi Gras Day, Episodes in the History of New Orleans Carnival. Welcome, Professor Mitchell.
Thank you.
We do tend to have an image of Mardi Gras as a big, rowdy parade, but just what is Mardi Gras?
Well, there is no one simple answer to that, but in New Orleans context, it is the final day of Carnival, the day before Ash Wednesday. It is now celebrated with organized parades and a great deal of national attention, but in the past, in the 18th century, it was simply a day of revelry. The parading tradition doesn't start until the 19th century. Mardi Gras worldwide, of course, is the day before Lent, but on the other hand, it also partakes of even older festivals. It obviously, for example, picked up some of the Roman Saturnalia. And in many countries, it's really an excuse, I think, to keep pre-Christian or pagan traditions alive. But in New Orleans, it's very much part of the calendar of the Christian church.
Now, why is Mardi Gras so closely identified with New Orleans?
New Orleans has publicized it better, and that may sound cynical, but I actually think that is the truth. Certainly, it is the largest carnival celebrations within the United States. Mobile actually has a prior claim, but they never reached the level of pure gaudiness and display that New Orleans did. And New Orleans has quite consciously been using carnival to sell itself to the wider American public since the 1880s.
Now, how does Mardi Gras relate to this whole concept of carnival that we see from early modern times on?
Well, carnival is a way for people to escape the normal social pressures, to turn things topsy-turvy, to indulge themselves. It is not so much as a revolutionary posture toward society, although some have argued that. It's really just a chance to thumb your nose at things that perhaps even you believe in most of the year, but that one day you let your id run riot. This existed, Mardi Gras existed in early modern Europe, a very strong tradition particularly in France. We have some very good studies of those carnivals. A strong tradition, obviously, in Venice, and the New Orleans Carnival, I think, is partly modeled on the one in Venice. It's a chance to express oneself and liberate oneself and pretend to be who you're not, and so maybe show who you really are. Maybe you're pretending the other days of the year. But it's also a tradition with rules and observances, and it provides a structure for people acting out their fantasies.
Now, you mentioned already that Mardi Gras has changed over the years. Just how has it? I mean, like in the appearance of the king of the Mardi Gras or the Rex?
Okay. As I discuss in my book, the notion that there should be a carnival parade, a Mardi Gras Day parade or parade in that season in New Orleans dates back well into the 1820s. But initially, they were unorganized, haphazard parade. Someone might put an ad in the newspaper saying everyone who wants to parade should put on a costume and meet at the Henry Clay statue or someplace like that. It wasn't until the 1850s that the notion arose that the parade should be organized in advance, that it should be, as they called it at the time, organized carnival. And oddly enough, this notion does not originate with the Catholic Creole population of New Orleans. It originated more in the American Protestant side of things. The original people who organized the crew of Momus were all of United States origin rather than of this sort of French strange city. And Momus began parading before the Civil War. The Civil War obviously brought a halt to, excuse me, I said Momus twice and I meant Comus in both cases. Comus was interrupted by the Civil War. And it wasn't until after the war that a decision was made to take all the unorganized maskers, as they were called, or promiscuous maskers, as they were called, and perhaps indeed they were in the modern sense, but this really just meant individual masters, and organize them into a parade that should take place on Mardi Gras Day itself. And the organization that did this sponsored a king of carnival, in fact, just announced that he was the king of carnival, and that was the creation of Rex, who dates back to the 1870s. After Rex appeared and the reappearance of Comus, other crews followed suit. So by the end of the 19th century, you had most of what are now regarded as the old line crews, ironically, some of which are no longer parading today over recent carnival controversies.
Now, an interesting remark that you make in your book is that carnival had far less to do with creating social tensions than with displaying them. And how is that particularly true in terms of class in New Orleans?
Well, carnival in its modern form, dating from the 1870s, was very much a procession organized by people who regarded themselves as the upper crust. And initially, they were organized against Reconstruction governments, which were biracial democracies, which this well-to-do white elite could not stomach. And it always had an air, even at best, that carnival was something the well-to-do and the social elite were organizing for the benefit of lesser sorts. And that always stuck in the craw of certain New Orleanians. And, of course, inherently there's something about the carnival spirit that resists being organized in any case. And at any time when class or racial tensions are particularly strong in the city, there will be violence during carnival, sometimes directed at the parades themselves, other times manifesting itself in other ways. Every time this has happened in the history of New Orleans, dating back at least until the 1850s, there has been quite understandable horror on the part of many New Orleanians that carnival is being disrupted by violence. But in fact, the violence displayed during carnival appears and reappears so often in New Orleans history that it's almost the carnival tradition in and of itself.
Now, what about race relations in New Orleans? Did carnival make these race relations better or worse over the years?
I'd be reluctant to say carnival made race relations better or worse. I would say that carnival has been very important for African-American New Orleanians to assert their dignity and to have a festive space of their own. Clearly, some of the traditions within the African-American community in New Orleans relating to carnival are really adaptations of West African traditions. They associated themselves with carnival not because of the Christian significance of carnival, but because Mardi Gras was a day where everybody was given more license than any other day of the year, and this permitted African Americans to organize and express themselves in a way they could not the rest of the year. And New Orleans probably gave more license to this kind of organization than most other states in the United States, although certainly not compared to, not any more so than Trinidad or in Saint-Domingue or in Brazil. And because of this, at the same time there's been the official tradition of carnival, there's also long been an African New Orleans, an Afro-New Orleans tradition as well. What happened within our lifetimes is that inevitably, with the breakdown of Jim Crow in New Orleans and the rise of black political participation, the question is raised and has been raised very vigorously in the 80s and 90s, why should black carnival be a submerged tradition and this traditional white-only, upper-crust-only carnival be the official carnival? And it's been very difficult for the old line crews, the crews representing the old organized whites-only tradition, to appreciate that in a new political set of circumstances, there are going to have to be new arrangements for something like carnival. Because even though carnival is to a certain extent privately sponsored, on the other hand, it requires a tremendous amount of city services. city licenses and permits, and you can't throw a party for several million people and not disrupt the city. And obviously the city has to be involved.
Now, the story of the Zulu crew, especially in the 60s, was a very interesting one. Could you tell us a little something about that?
Yes, the crew of Zulu, the 60s were not kind to the crew of Zulu. Zulu is the oldest organized black crew, and it started at the turn of the century. I don't suppose we can say that anymore. The turn of that century is compared to this century. It started as almost a burlesque of the white organizations. And a lot of the burlesque involved black-facing, even though these are African-American crew members. They nonetheless black-faced and painted themselves very much the way whites do when they acted black. It involved fairly silly imitation jungle costumes. It involved a lot of emphasis on drinking. It was a true carnivalesque crew, which offended the leaders of the black civil rights community in New Orleans during the 60s, who said, this is not the image we should be portraying of black people, that Zulu is just playing into the hands of white supremacists. And therefore, there was a lot of bickering within Zulu. Zulu, at one time, the reformers took over and tried to put together a more dignified parade, one which in and of itself was not well received, and two, suffered from the fact that the floats broke down and caught fire, I believe it was the night before. And then Zulu went back to their old-fashioned parade. A lot of energy in New Orleans was devoted to whether Zulu represented the black community or not. And that's an example of the phenomenon I think I demonstrate in my book, which is any major social or political swing that affects New Orleans is going to find expression in carnival. And the fact that the civil rights movement in New Orleans, unlike I would imagine anywhere else in the U.S., devoted itself to worrying about carnival organizations is symptomatic of how thoroughly carnival is intertwined in the city's fabric.
Well, we have less than a minute left, but perhaps you could tell us, as a native of New Orleans, what does Mardi Gras mean to you?
It means the chance to innovate within a tradition. So you simultaneously feel the long pull of people, of your ancestors, one way or another, creating this form in which you have the freedom to create yourself. But by creating, you add to the form, you add to the tradition, and therefore give something that can be passed down to the next generation of New Orleanians and indeed their descendants.
Well, thank you, Professor Mitchell.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Reed Mitchell, Associate Professor of History at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of All on a Mardi Gras Day, Episodes in the History of New Orleans Carnival.
Welcome back to Talking History. For our historic site of the week, for those of you who have been so taken by our interview that you'd like to experience Mardi Gras, Talking History's Cindy Workman is here to offer you some information on that celebration in New Orleans and other nearby locations.
Mardi Gras in New Orleans is the largest celebration in Louisiana. A huge street party begins in the French Quarter weeks before Fat Tuesday and culminates in a parade with larger-than-life floats, showers of beads and doubloons, and candy. If you don't want to fight the crowds, you can taste the excitement of Mardi Gras year-round at the Mardi Gras Museum at Kenner's Rivertown, USA, on the West Bank of New Orleans, or at the Fancy Faces near Covington, the Petit Paris Museum in St. Martinville, or the old U.S. Mint, which features an elaborate Mardi Gras exhibit. If you want to experience Mardi Gras Middle Ages style, check out the towns of Mamou, Iota, and Ossun for a festival that closely resembles the European festival from the Middle Ages, including the masked horsemen and their collection of the ingredients for a giant gumbo stew to be enjoyed by all.
Thank you, Cindy. Mardi Gras is not the only thing on our minds at this time of the year, of course. We also need to think about the annual ritual of paying our taxes. Recently, in the face of considerable public pressure, Congress passed another IRS reform bill. But will it make a difference? John Andrew, professor of history at Franklin and Marshall College, takes up that question in this week's op-ed. Andrew is the author of four books on the 1960s, including The Other Side of the 60s. He's currently working on a book, Politics and the IRS from Kennedy through Nixon. The title of John Andrew's op-ed is Restructuring the IRS. Any chance for real change?
After lengthy debate and several hearings, Congress has finally passed another IRS reform bill. What good will it do? There are at least two guides as to what the future might hold. First, there is a history of efforts to reform the IRS. Most of those in the past have come after public disclosure of serious abuses. In the early 1950s, many IRS employees were found guilty of taking bribes and fixing tax forms for friends. At least one congressional special committee studied the problem, and in 1954, the Congress passed a massive tax reform act. In many respects, this reform effort was successful. While it did not stop all internal abuses, it did beef up the Internal Security Division of the IRS and more closely monitor employee habits. Yet, as we heard at the most recent hearings, some IRS employees still peruse tax returns of friends, enemies, celebrities, or whomever else's taxes they choose to examine. Then, in the mid-1970s, following revelations of Nixon administration abuse of the IRS, another effort at reform emerged. This time, the disclosure provisions and access to tax returns were tightened, and tax returns were no longer considered public information. There is some evidence that this has worked, although it has not eliminated politically motivated pressure from Congress or the White House to examine various returns. At least now there is supposed to be a written record of these requests and their disposition. So our recent history provides some examples, and there are more, of efforts to reform the IRS. None have been completely successful. Moreover, none have attacked what now appears to be the central and underlying problem at the IRS, arrogance. The second guide to the future lies in the new tax reform bill. It seems to focus much more on tax cuts for the wealthiest 5 to 7% of Americans than on real reform. In addition, these reforms will result in a projected revenue loss of $30 billion. What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong is simple. The IRS remains today probably the largest organization dealing with the public at large, which does not have a customer service department. IRS arrogance and failure to deal satisfactorily, even humanely at times, with the general public lie at the core of complaints against the service. In mid-August, the IRS posted an invitation to comment on its proposed new mission statement. The two draft statements, neither longer than two sentences, failed to mention anything about customer service. Collecting money and having taxpayers meet their tax responsibilities, both important, of course, are the sole focus. Former IRS historian Shelley Davis noted last year that the underlying problem with the IRS was its inbreeding and arrogance. The new reform bill, by its failure to confront either of these problems, seems likely to make a few people rich and keep the rest of us angry.
You've been listening to John Andrew, professor of history at Franklin and Marshall College. Finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, where we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of historical nature that may be of interest to you. This week, we note two recently opened exhibits of American memorabilia. The first, American Originals, housed in the rotunda of the National Archives in Washington, D.C., displays items from its collection, including Lee Harvey Oswald's arrest warrant, Elvis Presley's letter to President Richard Nixon volunteering to be a federal agent, and Susan B. Anthony's indictment for trying to vote. The second exhibit is online at the Library of Congress website. It's called American Treasures of the Library of Congress, and presents an unprecedented exhibition of the rarest and most significant items relating to the nation's past. For further information on either of these exhibits, contact the National Archives or access the Library of Congress's homepage. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you will join us again next week for our special President's Day program, in which we will take a look at the history of presidential impeachment. In the meantime, we welcome to our family of radio stations WVXU in Cincinnati, and invite all of our listeners, new and old, to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.